further. Critics say that priorities are all wrong. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
On Saturday, a string of anti-system parties labelled by the Italian media as the Forces of Dissent gathered in Rome to discuss the challenges being faced by Italy and the EU and future strategies. The meeting was attended by political groups including More Sovereign and Popular Italy, Reclaim Italy, an alternative, formations advocating for the protection of Italy's sovereign interests and for shielding a growing number of Italians who are paying a heavy toll to what they call a dictatorship of neoliberalism.
In short, we are under a dictatorship, a regime that has stripped us all of dignity, rights. We can't get decent jobs anymore. Our constitution has been vilified. Our youngest generations have been taught the wrong values.
Independent journalists and geopolitical analysts also attended the meeting. They slammed the EU for its vulnerability to corruption and NATO for its belligerent posture. They also argued that the energy crisis was purposely triggered to favor the energy giants and their shareholders.
NATO is primarily responsible for what's happening in Ukraine. A long-planned operation which has also involved the US secret services since the 2014 coup in Ukraine. We believe nations should reclaim their sovereignty and be free to strengthen ties with any country they want.
This affection for politics is running wild in Italy. The turnout for last September's general elections was about 64%, the lowest ever recorded, 9% down compared to the 2018 vote.
Our party was boycotted when we ran in the elections last September. The Italian media simply ignored us. Furthermore, about 4 out of 10 Italians did not vote, meaning that the current parliament only partially represents the will of the people.
Following the outcome of Italy's latest elections held in September, which saw a right-wing coalition led by Giorgia Meloni emerging as winners, all anti-system parties have remained out of the parliament. The once anti-establishment five-star movement managed to garner 18% of the votes, but its section in the parliament seemed to have lost both power and potential now that the party has moved towards more moderate stances. Max Civili, Rome.
Since the riots began in September, anti-Iran media has been depicting the situation as a violent crackdown on so-called peaceful protesters. For the past 2 months, they have been running a propaganda campaign to further pressure Iran under the pretext of violating human rights. But are these peaceful protesters? Iran's intelligence ministry has recently reported the confiscation of huge cache of weapons and equipment used by terrorists. In fact, Iranian security forces have thwarted several arms smuggling operations and dismantled a number of operational cells affiliated with the terrorist organizations such as MKO. This comes as the illegal influx of weapons into the country is on the rise recently. The confiscated weapons were supposed to be transferred to Iran to be used in the recent riots. Last month, in an interview with the Persian service of the British state-funded broadcaster BBC, former White House National Security Advisor John Bolton said the, quote, Iranian opposition is now being armed with weapons. Bolton added that these arms are being smuggled into the country from the Iraq's Kurdistan region, praising the use of force against Iran's security forces. The recent foreign-backed riots in Iran have claimed hundreds of lives belonging to both security forces and ordinary people. In addition, by conducting acts of vandalism, violence, and insecurity, rioters have paved the way for separatist and terrorist groups to infiltrate the country and carry out brutal attacks against innocent people.
Smuggling huge amounts of weapons into Iran to be used in the recent foreign-backed unrest is merely aimed at undermining the country's security. But Iranian officials have time and again stated that Iran's security is a red line that no one is allowed to cross. Mahdi Abbasian, Tehran.
Okay.
Lebanon has arrested 185 people suspected of working for the Israeli spy agency since October 2019, when the Arab country's ongoing economic crisis became apparent.
This is Israel's intelligence agency's invasion of the Lebanese virtual sovereignty. The Israelis took advantage of the economic crisis and the fact that the Lebanese are looking for job opportunities with US dollars coming from abroad. And so they created fake companies through which they acquired thousands of resumes from Lebanese people. They were able to contact any one of those job hunters in the guise of foreign companies, while in reality they were Israeli recruiters.
Lebanese security sources have told AFP that the number has increased dramatically, from only 4 or 5 arrests per year.
One of the most notable examples of this was the busting of over 35 Lebanese and Palestinians that were gathering intelligence on Hezbollah and of the Palestinian factions in Lebanon for Israel. Israel, again, used a lot of fake companies and front groups to trap those kind of in a desperate economic situation into accepting these fake front opportunities.
Out of the 185 people arrested since 2019, 165 have been prosecuted and 25 convicted and sentenced. The economic collapse in Lebanon has taken its toll on the country in several ways, but it seems it's not the only reason for treason. Several collaborators admitted that they continued their communications with the Mossad out of sheer opposition to the resistance.
When we read the interrogation reports of those who were arrested, we understand that it was more than only giving intelligence. One of the suspects admits that he was asked to write articles aimed at sowing sedition amongst the Lebanese and inciting people against Hezbollah and resistance. They asked him, for example, to write articles which would give an impression that Hezbollah is linked to the Beirut port explosion in order to provoke hatred against the resistance movement.
Political analysts believe recruiting spies by the Israeli regime will continue since a military option is not on the table.
These kinds of more subtle forms of gaining influence in Lebanon, and especially putting people into a very desperate economic state and taking advantage of that, seems to both basically cut the losses on the military front that Israel and the U.S. Even know that it has unmatched against the resistance forces in the region.
Although Lebanon remains technically in a state of war with Israel, there has been no direct confrontation between the two sides since 2006. Nevertheless, Israel's espionage activities have never stopped. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
The 18th International Muslim Forum has summed up celebrations of the 1,100th anniversary of the adoption of Islam by the Volga, Bulgaria. Many religious figures addressed the International Forum. Russian Mufti Sheikh Ravil Gaynuddin called for a just world order from the standpoint of the East. Chairman of the Turkish Department of Religious Affairs, Ali Erbash, spoke about the connection between justice and security. Chief Justice of Palestine, Mahmoud Al-Habash, accused Israel and the United States of violating international law. The main two words, justice and a new world order, became the leitmotif of the plenary session.
We have gathered here to raise the voice of justice and moderation, to exchange scientific opinions through dialogue. The Islamic States, the Muslims of Russia, all of us must stand together against the liberalism that they are trying to impose on us. This false world view is in fact engaged in the seizure of the world's material wealth and assets. Our joint cooperation should be directed against this upstart arrogance, despotism, and oppression of the liberal world. The Islamic principles of the world view are the values that the world could take as an example.
Back in 1881, the Russian Muslim thinker and educator Ismail B. Gasprinsky wrote that in the near future, quote, Russia will be destined to become one of the significant Muslim states, which will not in the least diminish its significance as a great Christian power. The participants of the forum are convinced that his dream is coming true today. Russian Muslims, hand in hand with their partners, are making a unique contribution to renewing the global
discourse on justice. The rapprochement of the Islamic world with Russia and success in this matter is directly related to the openness of the Russian civilization to its Eastern heritage, including the spiritual tradition of Russian Muslims.
We are being imposed a globalist neoliberal understanding of the modern world order. The imposition is very aggressive. They encroached on a family. Many have caved into these patterns of the new world order. The Islamic world, which reads the Quran and is charged with energy and the word of the Quran, is trying to resist and adjoin those centers that are able to challenge and protect humanity from destructive energy. Russia is the defender of the classical traditional order set forth in the sacred scriptures. Therefore, one must follow this path, not lose hope, not give up, because this is a Quranic instruction to unite and be a single organism, a single ummah.
The participants of the forum believe that the time has come to talk about a just world order not only from the standpoint of the West, but also from the East.
Russia is celebrating the 1,100th anniversary of the adoption of Islam by the people of Volga, Bulgaria, marking the importance of Islam in the country. This year is commemorated with the participation of representatives from dozens of Muslim countries during various events. The anniversary is also an opportunity for Russia to strengthen its ties with participating Muslim countries that have been isolated by the West. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
Kubashevsky District, Donetsk. A child is wounded by Ukrainian shelling. An ambulance took her to the hospital. But a second didn't arrive fast enough, so a local volunteer, Andrei, puts the child's mother in the back of his van and drives her there himself. Ukraine has a history of shelling civilians in Donetsk since 2014. Over recent days, they've increased the slaughter. More than a dozen have been killed in the last 4 days. Nowhere in the city is safe. 2 supermarkets were hit in the space of 2 days.
The city has been hit hard today, multiple strikes around the center. The death toll is already up to 5. We're racing around the city to check out the damage.
We pass a market. It caught on fire due to a strike. Flowers are placed outside for a woman killed at the same spot a few weeks ago. We arrive at the site of another strike. There's a body on the ground and 2 more inside.
Now, while many of the attacks by Ukraine in Donetsk are aimed at civil infrastructure, administration buildings, some are simple terror attacks against civilians. The building here is a youth center. The woman who was killed is still lying just down there, covered in a blanket.
The woman was later identified as Maria Pirogova, a young deputy of the DPR authorities. Another killed was Vadim Lobozov, a singer in a music band.
Now, I've tried to talk to a couple of people at the scene here, but they didn't want to. They're simply too traumatized to speak. One man breaking down in tears by the side of the road. And frankly, my fixer, my translator, is very keen for us to get out of here because at any moment, these strikes can happen again. Right across the city, they've been happening today. And no doubt there'll be more anytime soon.
Andrei, the volunteer who took the mother to the hospital in Kubayevsky.
They shell the center of Donetsk on purpose, to scare people, to create an unstable zone in the city, so that people will complain, to provoke. To me, they're not warriors who fight with other warriors. They fight civilians, so I think they do not deserve to be called military. They should be classified as war criminals by a military court.
While Russia launches major attacks on energy infrastructure, in a shockingly underreported story, Ukraine is launching attacks on civilians, whom it claims to be its own citizens. Few people are on the streets today, as more strikes are expected. Johnny Miller, Donetsk.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
The limelight. The United States of America, or as what the publication Economist has described, that this United States of America is on the path to decline. This is what experts have acknowledged and had warned years before. From its broken economy to its political division and decadent culture, there is no glimpse of hope for the U.S. to be recovered. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for the second part, please. Guardian, in an article, noted the United States is a textbook example of a country headed towards civil war. The trends increasingly point one way, while nobody knows the future, little, if anything, is being done by anyone to try to prevent the collapse of the republic. Belief in democracy is ebbing. The legitimacy of institutions is declining. America increasingly is entering a state where its citizens don't want to belong to the same country. These are conditions ripe for political violence. No civil war ever has a single cause. It's always a multitude of factors that lead to decline and collapse. The current U.S. has several of what the CIA calls threat multipliers. Environmental crises continue to batter the country. Economic inequality is at the highest level since the founding of the country. And demographic change means that the U.S. will be a minority white country within just over two decades. All of these factors tend to contribute to civil unrest wherever they are found in the world. But the U.S. is more vulnerable to political violence than any other countries because of the discrepancies of institutions. For 40 years, trust in institutions of all kinds, the church, the police, journalism, academia, has been in free fall. Trust in politicians can hardly fall any lower. And there is no reason for trust. The Constitution, while unquestionably a work of genius, was a work of 18th century genius. It simply does not reflect, nor can it respond to, the realities of the 21st century. The divide between the American political system and any reflection of the popular will is widening, and increasingly it cannot be ignored. The Electoral College system means that in the near term, a Democrat will win the popular mandate by many millions of votes and still lose the presidency. The crisis of democracy will only grow. With around 345 election deniers on the ballot as candidates in November, the Republicans appear to have evolved a new political strategy, seemingly based on the gambling strategy of Joe Pesci's character in Casino. If they win, they collect. The American electoral system is already hugely localized, outdated, and held together by good faith. Any failure to recognize electoral outcomes, even in a few states, should result in a contested election in which nobody reaches the threshold of 270 electoral college votes. In that case, the Constitution stipulates a contingent election. And acclimatize yourself to this phrase now, in which each state gets a single vote. That's right. If no candidate in an American presidential election reaches the threshold of 270 electoral college votes, the House delegations from individual states, overwhelmingly dominated by Republicans, pick the president, with each state having one vote. In 1824, the candidate who won the popular vote and the most electoral college votes, Andrew Jackson, did not become president. John Quincy Adams fought his way through. A contingent election is one mechanism, just one, by which an American government could be perfectly constitutional and completely undemocratic at the same time. The right has been preparing for exactly such a reality for a while, with a phrase they repeat as if in hope that it will mean something if they say it enough. We are a republic, not a democracy. Quasi-legitimacy is what leads to violence, and America's political institutions are destined to become more and more quasi-legitimate from now on. One of the surest markers of incipient civil war in other countries is the legal system devolving from a nonpartisan, truly national institution to a spoil of partisan war. That has already happened in the U.S. America is rushing headlong into another civil war, and it's a matter of when, not if. As political scientist Professor Barbara F. Walker argues, civil wars are likely in the presence of two factors, autocracy and ethnic factionalism. When one considers the centrality of race to American politics, it is clear that ethno-nationalism is hastening the movement towards autocracy. Think about the role of race in the first civil war and the one we are headed towards. It's well documented that the repulsive nature of the institution of slavery was the principal cause of the civil war, driven by moral as well as economic and political concerns. In the 19th century America, the Democratic Party was a relatively reactionary institution in the South, whereas the Republican Party was a relatively progressive institution located in the North. Republicans supported the abolition of slavery, whereas the 19th century Democrats were all for it. Regardless of the outcome of the war, driven as it was by the prospect of material gain or loss, moral redemption or immorality, the war came to rest on the fulcrum of race and racism. Throughout history, political identity in the U.S. has ultimately been driven by the party's respective positions on race, with divisions sorting primarily by the way of racial identity and racial attitudes. Contemporary Republicans, for instance, tend to be white and relatively racist. Democrats are more likely to draw from a more diverse pool and, as such, are typically less racist. To illustrate this point, Republicans are far more alarmed by a diversifying country. Likewise, white people were and are more likely to support Trump, driven by the anxiety associated with the rapid racial diversification of their country. What, you may ask, do white people and the Republican Party have in common? Well, 80% of Republican voters are white. The consequences of the centrality of race and racism to American politics and the threat of internal war are dire. It was racism that was ultimately responsible for the rise of the Tea Party. A reaction to Obama's racialized presidency, the Tea Party, now the MAGA movement, in turn moved the GOP to the right, eventually setting the stage for Trump. With Trump pushing the big lie that the 2020 election was stolen, and many Republicans buying it into, the stage is set for another American war of all against all. They have seen this before. The civil war, as it happens, was set in motion by the refusal of the Democrats to accept Abraham Lincoln as the legitimate winner of the 1860 contest given his views on slavery. He thought it's morally wrong. But it wasn't the economics of slavery that motivated the South's insistence on maintaining what was known as the peculiar institution. Only 3.2% of white Southern families owned slaves. Clearly, then, the maintenance of slavery as an economic institution carried no value for almost all white Southerners. With economic reasons absent, why were white Southerners willing to fight a war over slavery? The Southern way of life, white supremacy. As part of Southern culture, these people were not ready for forfeit their social dominance relative to the black community. these conditions remain in place as many white people or Republicans confront the fear that by 2044, they will no longer be in the ethnic majority, they feel the need to take drastic measures to maintain white supremacy. It's all they have ever known. It happened in 1860s. What's to prevent it from happening now? Look for the next civil war to take place after the 2024 election cycle, when the next wave of violence is likely to emerge. Similar to the original civil war, there is too much at stake for both sides. Then, as now, the threats are existential. In the 19th century, Democrats viewed the newly established Republican Party as a threat to their way of life. Republicans, for their part, saw Southern intransigence on the issue of slavery as a threat to the Union. Today, Republicans, driven by the existential threat of losing their white country, will continue their attack on democracy as a means towards preserving America for real Americans. Democrats, on the other hand, see the magnification of the GOP as an existential threat to liberal democracy. Election-related violence generally takes place when the following four factors are present: a highly competitive election that can shift power, partisan division based on identity, winner takes all, two-party election systems in which political identities are polarized, and an unwillingness to punish violence on the part of the dominant group. All four are present in America now and will be more amplified in 2024. Americans are almost there. White angst over increasing racial diversity makes another Trump candidacy likely, pushing them into autocracy. Democrats are having none of that. They will resist going down the slippery slope of autocracy the same way that their 19th century counterparts, the party of Lincoln, refused to let the Confederacy bust up the Union. Likewise, should Democrats prevail in 2024, Republicans will revolt. The January 6th Capitol attack is a forewarning.
Us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The U.S.-backed Saudi-led war in Yemen continues to take its toll on the civilian population, especially children. According to the U.N., more than 11,000 children are known to have been killed or maimed, toll likely to be far higher, while hundreds of thousands more remain at risk of death from preventable diseases or starvation. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at how can the U.S. and EU support and back the Saudi regime when civilian lives, especially children, are being lost, and why the international community as a whole has fallen way short when it comes to Yemen. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Elijah McNair joins us. He's a journalist and political analyst from Brussels. Fra Hughes, journalist, activist, and director at Palestine Aid, joins us from Belfast.
The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. Frahius, I'll start with you, and I want to zoom in on the position that you have in your title as an activist. When you hear about the alarming stats, which I'm just going to round it up, I don't want to just keep hashing it out throughout the program, 11,000 children to have been killed or maimed, thousands have lost their lives, obviously hundreds of thousands remain at risk of death from the keyword preventable diseases or starvation, and then you have about 2.2 million Yemeni children acutely malnourished, one quarter of them under the age of five, and then most at risk of cholera, measles, and other vaccines. Your reaction to that?
I think they're very sobering statistics, and I think that the very important thing about statistics are, apart from the fact that they're factually accurate, although as you've stated, they could be a lot higher than has been recorded, I think every statistic represents a person, be it a child, a father, a brother, a sister, a mother, an auntie or an uncle. Every preventable death, every death that has occurred due to Saudi Arabia's disgraceful kind of attack and punitive punishment of the people of Yemen. Behind every statistic, there is a human being, there is a wider family, there is a community and wider society. When you look at how many people have died, how many people are facing hunger, the absolute kind of travesty and tragedy that is existing and how people are forced to live every day, it's all preventable. It could all stop tomorrow. It's not just a matter of political will. It's a matter of humanitarian desire by the people involved to end this kind of horror show that's being inflicted upon the people of Yemen. I mean, it just struck me earlier before you went on air, I was thinking, you know, is this all down to one man? Is this one person's ego? Is this Mohammed bin Salman? Is it all down to him? I know he's backed by America. I know he's backed by Britain. I know he's backed by Israel. I know he has his own kind of twisted political ideology that has him involved in the war on Yemen. But I do wonder if he was not in charge. I also believe possibly before 2015. I don't know if he was the minister for the army and stuff in Riyadh, but it seems to be since he took over the reins of power in Riyadh that this has all come about. So
sure.
It's tragic and it's sad and it's eminently preventable.
Well, the key word, as you mentioned repeated my stance on this, preventable is what is the focus in my next question to you, Elijah Magnier, also, because Ansarullah has come out and said that, well, they have been looted by over $13 billion worth of their oil wealth over the past 5 years. This is money, obviously, that could have been spent in terms of the revenues they generated that's been stolen on their population, on their local population. And that's kind of sad. Why is it that this looting, which continues to this day, a lot of it to have been attributed to the UAE, still continues, even though, of course, Ansarullah is trying to find a way to stop that?
Well, actually, no war has been more deadly over the last 8 years than the Saudi-U.S. Western war on Yemen. The theft of the Yemeni oil falls into the same policy of the West to deprive the Yemeni from their natural resources, as they are doing with Syria, and is to starve further the Yemeni population, because it is not enough to see more than half of the population starving. 23 million in Yemen are suffering because of the war, and the double standard of the West is so obvious that we have people lecturing us about what's happening in Ukraine and what Russia is doing in Ukraine and how we need to feel in support of the Ukrainian, and the war has been going on only for the last 8 to 10 months. So we have 8 years almost of massacring, mainly children under the age of five, 500,000, as you rightly said, and 2.2 million children malnourished. All that is really going just invisible to mainstream media, to the Saudi, to the Emiratis, to the Americans, to the Europeans, who pretend to be supportive of the humanitarian cause of the world. So all that is a pure double standard on how we deal with the poorest country in the Middle East. But when it comes to a country in the European continent, so we change all our values suddenly. And stealing the revenue of Yemen, preventing Sana'a from having its share, from having the salary of the employers, from allowing the airport to function properly, from allowing the harbor to receive all the goods that are needed in Yemen, this is a really genocide that's happening under our eyes, and we feel completely numbed about it because this is what the West wants us to avoid and not to look at for the last 8 years.
Sure. Well, when we want to take a look at a response to this, Frahis, in terms of trying to figure out how we can help, we cumulatively, as in the notion of us, the world altogether, we need to, because we keep asking, what about the international community? Why is it not doing enough? This so-called international community has to go through, if it wants to do something on a large scale, through organizations like the UN. Well, the UN doesn't even have enough money to fulfill its budget. The news came out last week, and we've heard that scenario before. Other organizations cannot live up to the monumental task of trying to provide for all these people. But there is one source that can do that. That source, based on the revenues for one day, generates $700 million in profits every single day. And that's Saudi Arabia's Aramco. Just for one day, and that money, that could help solve the problem. I don't know to what degree, but to a large degree, of what's happening in Yemen. What does that say when Saudi Arabia doesn't want to give up profits for one day to help that situation?
It maybe proves that money is more important than human life, that the value they place on money is more important than the value that they place on human life. I mean, when we witness kind of what's happening in Yemen, again, you know, I see parallels with Gaza. Gaza's under siege by air, by land, and by sea, by the Zionist entity. It figures out how many calories the people can get by on per day. It prevents children moving from Gaza to the West Bank or indeed Israel in order to receive medical treatment. It bans all kinds of building supplies, medical supplies, even food supplies, fuel supplies from reaching Gaza. So we have exactly the same situation in Yemen. And if you look at what's happening in Gaza, and you look at how the Zionist entity is stealing the resources of the Palestinian people in the gas and oil fields that are off the Gazan coast, we witness exactly the same thing in Yemen. A lot of wars are about political control. They are also about land acquisition and expansionism for the countries involved. But the bottom line has always been money, and it is about money. And so long as the UAE and Saudi Arabia and others continue to steal the oil from the ports in Yemen, then I think this will continue because there is simply money to be made. If you talk about the hypocrisy of the West, we could talk about that forever and a day. I remember in, I think it was 1985, don't quote me in the year, when they did the big band aid concerts and they raised millions upon millions for the starving and the dying in Africa. I see no band aid concert for Yemen. I look at my Facebook feed, all I see are people cheering England leaving the World Cup. All I see is people cheering Morocco, possibly having a huge upset over France. Yemen is not even on my timeline. It's not even on my friends list of things that people are genuinely concerned about.
Sure.
Because there is international coverage, and the West is quite happy to allow millions of people to starve and die while it suits their political purposes to do so.
Indeed. Well, you know what? You mentioned a good point there, that it's not ranking. As our guest there said, Elijah Magnier, he was mentioning the fact that it's not ranking on top of the list, whether it's the news, whether it's celebrities maybe, or people who have something to say from politics and what have you. But it's, I want to have your elaboration on this money that's generated by Saudi Arabia, because it's quite a big figure, $700 million a day. You know, instead of funding their Saudi channel to encourage incitement and a revolution inside the Islamic Republic, of which they go after every second of the day, perhaps that money, not perhaps, but that money, I'm sure, if you agree, can help the starving people in Yemen and prevent some of the people dying there. The fact that it's not doing that, nor is it, I'm sure, being pressured by its allies to do that, like the U.S., what does that say about the regime there in Riyadh?
Well, the regime in Saudi Arabia, because it says, since Mohammed bin Salman said it overtly, that he wants to transport the battle into in Iran itself. That was an obvious declaration that he is also behind all the rioters and all the attempts to change, the failed attempt to change the regime in Iran. And that's something that the U.S. support. And then they claim they have humanitarian day on the 10th of this month by saying, on the 10th of December, by saying that this is what we are celebrating. So all the money are good as long as they are invested in curbing the population and regimes who are not obedient to the U.S. Directives and policy. That is okay. They can invest as much money as they want. They can even direct all the resources of the media to concentrate on something false and promoting incorrect narrative just to topple the regime and create coup d'etat under the name of democratic color revolution. For that, they can invest a lot of money. But to invest money in reconstructing Yemen, that is not possible. To invest money in buying weapons to Ukraine to continue watching how the Ukrainians are killed with the Russian, that is possible. So from one day to another, America is investing $50 million in one day sending to Ukraine so far, $66 billion to build Ukraine, reconstruct Ukraine with arsenal and weapons, but not a penny invested in Yemen, and not even the same resources that come out of Yemen. And here I allude to the Yemeni oil that is stolen because the West is in need of oil and they are taking the Yemeni and the Syrian oil. And this is should in theory create an outrage of all those who pretend to support the humanitarian cause around the globe. But because it is Yemen, because as your guest rightly said, it's Palestine, because it is unrest in Iran, there is a lot of investment to support the Israelis, to support the unrest in Iran, and support the terrorists that are crossing Iraq to do such an act, and inside Iran to do act of terrorism. So that for that, they have money to invest, but not in Yemen.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're going to expand a little bit about the regional security that involves Yemen with not a new actor, but a new energy resurfacing in a different way. We're going to get to that in a minute. I'll explain what I mean by that. But Fra Hughes, the narrative is something that needs to also have some new definitions to it. Not new definitions, but to have the general public be informed of the way this narrative is being played out when it gets covered in the news, which is a false one. And that is the way, for example, the way that the U.S. sees Yemen and Western media in turn, where they say Yemen's internationally recognized governments. Well, this internationally recognized governments, I'm not too sure which international part of it is recognizing the government that they're talking about, because the one inside of Yemen, backed by millions of these Yemenis, is what we see when we do have coverage of that. Hundreds of thousands, if not millions, would pour out on the streets and support Abdelmalek al-Houthi or support the Ansarullah movement. I mean, there's obviously a huge disconnect there. Or when they talk about a Saudi-led military coalition, what coalition? The last time we checked, it's only Saudi Arabia and the UAE, unless you want to count the outside factors like the ones that provide military assistance like the U.S. or maybe some EU countries. So shouldn't the narrative also be something that should be covered here?
You see, the first casualty of war is truth. That's what we're talking about here. We are not hearing the truth. We are hearing the propaganda from the Western imperialist elite. A lot of the coverage in the West is obviously for Western audiences. If I turn on the UK television news, which I try my best not to, I will have my head and my emotions and everything twisted and turned upside down with the emotional, emotive propaganda that they use when it comes to Ukraine, when it comes to Palestine, and it comes to other conflicts throughout the world. So it's important that the real truth and the real narrative gets as wide an audience as possible. But when you have the censorship against Press TV, which we've recently seen with the Euro satellite channels, And I believe now RT, which has been banned in most of Europe and North America, Canada, and other countries, is now, I don't know, 20 or 30 countries within the old Soviet sphere of influence that have banned all the RT channels. So we're witnessing a huge propaganda war where if you're only told one side of any narrative, you have no counterbalance and you have no way to view the prism of the information that you're being given in its totality. So the propaganda war, when we had, we talk about the thousands and hundreds of thousands of dead innocent civilians in Yemen. 600,000 Iraqi children died, and Madeleine Albright said she thought that the price was worth it. 600,000 babies.
Mm-hmm.
And she said the price was worth it. This is, it's not double standards, it's not hypocrisy, it is actually the kind of state, you use the word narrative, it's the state narrative being used by the capitalist elite in all these Western countries. We talk about Western society, we talk about Western media, we talk about mainstream media, we talk about, you know, the civilized West. It makes up less than 20% of the population of the world. It has an inordinate amount of money, finance, power, and influence. It's trying to hold on to all that by whatever means necessary. It's impoverishing, the West is impoverishing its own citizens in order to keep the rich and the elite in their positions of power and influence. And it has always robbed, stolen, and occupied, and raped the global South, and it's continuing to do so. So nothing's changed from the Middle Ages, and the narrative that we are being told by the mainstream media in the West is a total fabrication and a lie.
Okay. Well, let me now get to what I spoke about Elijah Magnier, and that was a not-so-new face, but a country that perhaps has a new footing in the region, and this is based... And I'd like to get your reaction on, based on the visit and the lavish and extravagant, I should say, reception that Saudi Arabia had of the Chinese President Xi Jinping. Now, the summit of the Persian Gulf countries of the GCC came out with some points. One of them was that China supports Yemen's safeguarding sovereignty, independence, unity, and territorial integrity, and support parties in Yemen in settling issues through political means. Do you see any way that Xi Jinping can play a role, given the context of how it had all these multi-billion-dollar deals with Saudi Arabia, and how it's going to be a provider, or it's going to be a buyer? Not that it wasn't before, but now it's cemented that it's going to be probably the number one buyer of Saudi oil, amongst other business deals. That it could play a role in settling this issue politically. Since the positive part about this that I can see is that it doesn't involve the U.S.
I think China is holding the stick in the middle. It is flirting with the Middle Eastern countries by supporting the unity and integrity of Yemen, also supporting a Palestinian state, and it supports the integrity of Syria. So all these slogans and big titles are part of the general policy that China is carrying out, just to say, I stay on the equal distance of all the countries in the Middle East, but also around the world as well. China is not made to be a confrontational country or a belligerent, and doesn't have intention to start a war or to even confront the Saudi or confront the U.S. Now, we have seen how the Saudis are taking advantage of China to send a message to the U.S. by signing a deal of $30 billion, just to say that I have other options. But it doesn't mean China is going to start working and be really active in support of the unity of Yemen and in support of a Palestinian state. The message that China is sending is China offering a model where all the countries in Asia need to be prosper and to develop, because it's important to have its plan to have all the harbor, the railway infrastructure built in every single country in the region, not only in Asia, but also to link Asia, Africa, and Europe, because China is offering a model that the U.S. is afraid of, because the U.S. went into Asia and created war, killed millions of people, and destroyed the economy of several countries, and a country that doesn't submit imposed sanctions like Iran, like Syria, like Lebanon, because they refused the U.S. policy. So China is not going to challenge the U.S. because China doesn't want to be under more sanctions than there are already 330 sanctions imposed on China. So it wants to keep the Americans away from its shore. It wants the Americans not to support Taiwan. And it doesn't want to interfere in Yemen by sending humanitarian support or reconstructing. It will not be allowed to go to Yemen to do so. China tried to do the same in Lebanon and was not allowed, and try also in Syria and wasn't not allowed, and try in Iraq, and it cost the resignation of the Prime Minister Adel Abdel Mahdi, who was removed in the street by the pro-U.S. So I don't think China is going to carry out any particular role in supporting Yemen or in supporting Palestine or in challenging the U.S. hegemony in the Middle East, in Asia, or anywhere else. I think the Americans are very aggressive now because they are challenged in Russia. They are challenged in Europe. Their policy is not going to hold the ground. Here in Brussels, we have the European officials who disagree on everything domestic, and they don't know what to do because of the lack of energy. So the whole world is really unstable today.
I have 30 seconds to give to you only for our Hughes. Iran has called for the formation of an inclusive government, the Iranian foreign minister adding that we believe that it's necessary to form this government where all Yemeni parties participate. There has been a truce that was no longer in effect now for, I think, a couple months, even though the truce has still lasted. There haven't been major attacks happening on a continual basis. How can the momentum towards a political solution, with the idea of Iran not being a bad one from what it sounds, to be enacted?
Well, all war ends in compromise, dialogue, and the cessation of the violence. And the only way perhaps for that to happen going forward is to allow a national coalition unity government to be formed where all players have a stake at the table on behalf of their constituents and hopefully be elected and have a mandate and go forward together as one unified country, tackling the ills that have befallen.
Sorry about that. We're just fresh out of time. Farah Hughes, journalist, activist, and director of the Palestine Aid Belfast. And Elijah Magnier, thank you for your contribution, journalist and political analyst from Brussels. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Tapwe, it's goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.